This is The Takeaway for Thursday, June 15th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And is this the big forward leap? In the weeks of investigating the Trump administration and its connection to Russian hacking and influence in the elections, well, this was the essential question asked at last week's hearings where former FBI Director James Comey testified.
Do you believe this will rise to the obstruction of justice?
I don't know. That's Bob Mueller's job to sort that out.
Bob Mueller, the special counsel in this case. The Washington Post broke the story that, in fact, that's where special counsel Bob Mueller's investigation is now leading. Whether the president attempted to obstruct justice in his interactions with administration officials. President Trump says he was told by former FBI Director James Comey that he was not under personal investigation, but following Comey's firing on May 9th, the Washington Post has reported that special counsel Mueller began looking into the obstruction of justice charges. Central to the obstruction of justice question are interviews with a number of intelligence officials, including Daniel Coates, the current director of National Intelligence, Mike Rogers, head of the National Security Agency. Mark Kasowitz, President Trump's personal attorney for the Russia investigation, said the following through a spokesman. He said the FBI leak of information regarding the president is outrageous, inexcusable, and illegal. And this morning, President Trump predictably tweeted, "They made up a phony collusion with the Russians' story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story," and went on to call the investigation the greatest single witch hunt in American political history. Who the they is in this case is a little bit hard to decipher, but maybe we can figure that out. Lanny Davis is a former White House special counsel under President Bill Clinton between 1996 and 1998, co-founder of the law firm Davis, Goldberg & Galper. Davis says the long game is what matters in cases like this. Quick conclusions aren't necessarily correct ones.
First of all, it's a case in process, so we have to be careful about assuming guilt. And we all know that a president is not held to a criminal standard, but to a standard that upholds values as opposed to law. So that's the big difference. But if this were just a legal case, this distinguishes Mr. Trump from Andrew Johnson and from President Clinton, who were the only two other presidents. President Clinton was held to a non-legal standard, and Andrew Johnson most certainly was held to a political standard because there was no criminal accusation against Andrew Johnson. He offended the political sensibilities and defied the House of Representatives about Reconstruction and about the Civil War. It was a political case. This is the clearest example of what seems to be a criminal act by a president. Even going back to Richard Nixon, who is our other example, which is closest because he was accused of obstruction of justice and was probably guilty of obstruction of justice, but this is different than anything else that we've ever seen in American history.
It would appear that so much that's already on the record here is incriminating for Donald Trump. And I'm, you know, the president fired FBI Director Comey. He said to Lester Holt on NBC that Russia was the reason. Comey himself said that Mueller would have to go down this road because words like, "I hope this investigation goes away." I mean, it all just seems a part of a pattern.
The irony of history here, and we are watching history being made day by day, is that President Trump brought this on himself by the firing of James Comey. Mr. Comey actually exchanged at his hearing that you don't have to order somebody to do something. And Thomas A. Becket was killed simply because Henry II said, "Will someone rid me of this grievous priest?" Mr. Comey made it pretty clear that he was ordered to do something, even though the expression was, "I hope." That in and of itself is an obstruction of justice if the special counsel believes Comey. So now it's down to he says. And I think Mr. Mueller is doing his job to find supporting evidence, even if it's an inference and not direct, that Mr. Comey is telling the truth. That's why he's now interviewing the heads of the intelligence agencies to see whether Mr. Trump asked them to interfere by persuading Mr. Comey to back off on the Flynn investigation. And that is additional evidence that Comey is telling the truth and that Mr. Trump is not.
The central part of the Washington Post story that originally broke this is, as you've said, that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is going to conduct interviews with Daniel Coates, who's the current director of national intelligence, Mike Rogers, head of the National Security Agency. What can those people tell him that will add to what we already know?
Well, if they want to go to jail, they'll lie, but they don't have to be under oath to commit a crime. There's a statute for false statement to a federal agent that does not have to be a sworn false statement. So they're going to tell the truth. If they refuse, as they did before the Senate Intelligence Committee, then they will be issued a subpoena by a grand jury, and then they will either have to take the Fifth Amendment, which will automatically require that they will be fired, or at least if they're not fired, that will probably be another impeachable offense. Two heads of our intelligence agencies have to answer questions before a federal grand jury. They're stuck. I think it's easy for your listeners to understand here, whether you like Trump or not. I'm trying to put my politics aside here and compare this to the precedents of Richard Nixon, Andrew Johnson, and President Clinton. I'd love to explain the differences, but the fact is, right now, we're looking at a case of criminal activity by the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. He can't be indicted. It's up to the House of Representatives to impeach him and the Senate to remove him. But this is a very strong criminal case, and at least Mr. Comey's version is corroborated. He could be convicted, certainly indicted, and he could be convicted in a court of law.
Lanny Davis, former White House special counsel under President Bill Clinton, is co-founder of the law firm of Davis, Goldberg, and Galper. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Lanny, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, John.
Yesterday, the Senate demonstrated some strong bipartisan consensus, imposing new sanctions on Russia and strengthening the ones already in place. The measures would also make it tougher for President Donald Trump to lift the sanctions on his own. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillich has more. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So is this specifically in response and in concert with Europe's opposition to the war in Ukraine, or are these sanctions specifically out of some inchoate anger with Russia because of all this mess that's occurred since the election?
Oh, John, those things and more. So the Senate has been itching to crack down on Russia even above current sanctions for years. After the Russian annexation of Crimea and their fomenting of the war in eastern Ukraine in response to Russia's propping up of the Assad regime. And then, of course, the unanimous conclusion by the intelligence community that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election. There's been a dam of frustration built up behind all of these issues. Also, add on to that, Senate frustration on both sides of the aisle that President Trump not only has not publicly taken seriously the idea that Russia meddled in the U.S. election and has thrown cold water on the idea and even doubted it into microphones and on Twitter, but has also made moves and signals that he wants to relax sanctions against Russia. That is why the Senate is trying to snatch back some authority from President Trump here. Listen to Chuck Schumer, who was on the Senate floor before a huge bipartisan vote of 97 votes yesterday.
It's particularly significant, Mr. President, that a bipartisan coalition is seeking to reestablish Congress, not the president, as the final arbiter of sanctions relief. Considering that this administration has been too eager, far too eager in my mind, to put sanctions relief on the table. These additional sanctions will send a powerful bipartisan statement that Russia and any other nation who might try to interfere with our elections will be punished.
You'd expect Schumer to say that. What do the high-profile Republicans say about this apparent dispute, serious dispute with the president?
Yeah, well, 97 votes on the Senate floor yesterday. Right. You can see that there's pretty broad support for this. I went to Bob Corker. He's a Trump supporter, of course, but also chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He says for him, this goes back to the Obama years, too. He just wants to see Congress take authority from the president, any president, he says, on authority on sanctions. And I'll ask you to remember when you listen to Corker here that presidents usually have broad discretion when it comes to sanctions. And this bill says that President Trump cannot relax sanctions against Russia unless Congress approves it first. Listen to Corker.
Look, I'm sorry. As you know, I pushed for congressional review under the last president, and we passed congressional review, if you remember. And so I'm sorry, I'm a congressional review guy. I think for the last 40 years, Congress has ceded way too much authority to the executive branch on foreign policy issues. And this is something that we started pushing back against in the last administration.
So this is really a separation of powers issue. And we're back really right to the center of what was the argument for almost 8 years of the Obama administration.
Well, look, in some ways, it is a separation of powers issue. And Corker is couching it that way. He says, look, I've been trying to do this ever since Obama. So I'm into Congress getting this authority. Certainly lawmakers in general want the authority, and the White House isn't going to want to lose it, which partly explains why Rex Tillerson has said very little positive about this. And the White House hasn't said they will sign this. Now, here's part of the sweetener. These new Russia sanctions are attached to some new sanctions against Iran that President Trump probably would want to sign. So they have some tough choices coming. And so does the House when they get a hold of this to see if they want to try to weaken this deal in a way that might get President Trump to sign it. The House and Speaker Paul Ryan have said very, very little about this major vote in the Senate and whether they would support it or not. But separation of powers is only one issue. And I want to draw this line a little bit brighter, because listen to Jeff Sessions just this week when he was testifying in the Intelligence Committee and was asked about whether before he recused himself in early March from all things Russia at the Justice Department, whether Russian meddling in the U.S. election in 2016 was on his radar as Attorney General.
You received no briefing on the Russian active measures in connection with the 2016 election.
No, I don't believe I ever did.
And so,
now, John, it's that piece of tape that will combine the separation of powers, the old issue between Congresses and presidents, with this new issue of frustration among members of Congress on both sides of the aisle that President Trump, amid the widening and deepening Russia probe, is not taking the actual security threat seriously. And they're trying to force his hand to do it here.
Well, beyond that, it's Trump versus his cabinet. It's Trump versus the Senate in that vote yesterday. We shall see where it goes from here. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Cop shows on television celebrate the high-tech procedures and tools available to detectives and lawyers to explore complicated microscopic evidence. But has the playing field been unleveled by the newest high-tech tools in law enforcement? Billy Ray Johnson, a defendant in California, was sentenced to life without parole in 2015 for a series of burglaries and sexual assaults. His sentence was based in part on the results of True Allele, a software tool that analyzes traces of DNA from crime scenes. But Johnson's attorney had no access to True Allele's source code to check it for bias and accuracy. So Johnson went to prison without the chance to challenge the evidence that found him guilty. Rebecca Wexler is a fellow at the Legal Aid Society and a resident at the Data and Society Research Institute. She says secrecy surrounding criminal justice technology is a troubling new prospect for the justice system.
There's an ongoing debate about whether some of these automated tools are good or bad. Mm-hmm. And some people say they can help correct human error, and other people say they can make error worse. I'm actually talking about something else, which is ownership.
Mm-hmm.
That as these tools enter the criminal justice system, they're bringing new kinds of intellectual property claims with them. And those are the claims I'm most concerned about.
And this deals with whether you can own DNA, whether the intellectual property of someone's distinctive DNA is so tied up in intellectual property rights that it can't be used as evidence.
The intellectual property protection of choice for the developers of computer systems are trade secrets. developers are arguing that their trade secrets interests should allow them to withhold information from the accused. So today, you could be investigated based on secret software, convicted based on secret evidence, and sentenced based on a secret assessment. And I think one of the most concerning parts of this process is that these trade secrets protections, courts are granting these trade secrets protections even at trial, where supposedly defendants' procedural rights are supposed to be the strongest. So our legal system promises defendants certain rights, a right to confront their accusers, a right to present a defense, a right to do this in a public trial. And as automated software programs come into the system, developers are claiming that their trade secrets should erode those rights.
In the case of Billy Ray Johnson, where his guilt or innocence is very much determined by some of this evidence, is he blindfolded as a defendant based on the protections that have already been given to the company through Allele that has created this evidence that is incriminating him?
Yes, in a sense, he's blindfolded. I think that's a good analogy. Billy Ray Johnson tried to subpoena or discover the source code for this software program that was used to analyze DNA evidence against him. And he tried to discover this pre-trial, before his trial, when he wanted to challenge whether the evidence could come in. Then he tried again to discover that information at trial so that he or his expert witness could cross-examine the developer of this technology about how the technology works. One of the reasons we have procedural safeguards in the criminal justice system that we're supposed to be able to cross-examine people is because we're concerned that people lie. People might lie on the witness stand. And software programs can also lie. Computer systems can have errors or bias. They can have Volkswagen-style fraud. And so the same procedural protections that apply normally should still apply when we're talking about a computer system. Unfortunately, in Billy Ray Johnson's case, the court allowed the developer to withhold that information because it was a trade secret.
Rebecca Wexler is a fellow at the Legal Aid Society and a resident at the Data and Society Research Institute. Rebecca, thanks.
Thank you.
Juries have a tough job in big cases or small. But what are the challenges for juries in the high-profile trials of celebrity Bill Cosby, where the jury is sequestered for deliberations and was selected in Pittsburgh even though the trial is being held near Philadelphia? Then there's the court in Minnesota awaiting a verdict in the case of the police officer accused in the death of Philando Castile. How should jurors deal with the added pressure of deciding cases involving celebrities or a high-profile issue like police brutality? Dr. Melissa Gomez is the president of MMG Jury Consulting and the author of Jury Trials Outside In.
When a case is in the media, the jury knows that people are watching. There's going to be judgments of what their decisions are, and they want to make sure, number one, they have the pressure to make sure that the job is done because people want the answer to the question, and also they want to make sure that they get it right.
Although in the case of someone like Bill Cosby, I mean, he's been around forever, and so everyone has some sort of sense of Bill Cosby, and then the sense of these allegations, they've been around for quite a while. I mean, it would be impossible to keep the pressure off the jury from, say, a male jury member who, if I vote not guilty, I mean, my wife will never speak to me again kind of thing. I mean, these pressures are real.
The pressures are real, and there are dueling pressures happening, especially for this jury that's going into the fourth day of deliberation. Number one, they have the pressure to actually come to a consensus. I mean, it's getting more and more possible that this could end up being a hung jury, which likely disappoints everyone. But also, you know, in terms of those pressures of what's going to happen when they go home, of what's going to happen when they make a particular decision. But what I've seen, especially when jurors are really they're into it, they're in the room, they're with the other jurors, they've been entrenched in this case for so long, is that their desire to make the right decision often is more important.
In the case of the Philando Castile killing and the fact that police are involved and inspires very polarized positions, and a verdict can turn a city into a community in flames. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's a different kind of pressure. So this is a much broader pressure that has to do more with political ideation. It has to do with more of an issue that is happening in society. And in some ways, I think these kinds of pressures are more intense than the Bill Cosby's, because it has to do with things that that have an impact on the community. For most of the time, the police are being found not guilty. And so that can swing both ways.
But isn't that wrong for a jury to be concerned about the community when really it's guilt or innocence that they're asked to decide?
Well, it depends on the person. So there is a concept, it's actually a concept called jury nullification, where the jury might look at the law, they might look at the situation, and they might say, you know what, there's a bigger purpose at issue here, and maybe I need to be a voice of that bigger purpose. There still obviously needs to be evidence in order to convict a particular police officer. So this is sort of one of those things that when juries are determined where they're sort of on the edge and trying to figure out whether to convict or not, it can be something, these kinds of pressures, these kind of foundations, these kinds of attitudes can push them to one side or the other.
Melissa Gomez is president of MMG Jury Consulting and the author of Jury Trials Outside In. Thanks so much, Melissa.
Great to be here.
Much has been made of the dismissals and resignations since the election of President Trump, James Comey, Mike Flynn. But the process of appointing federal positions in the new administration in the first place is moving at a snail's pace. The U.S. is unusual in that it places 4,000 executive branch positions for an incoming president to fill. For President Trump, that means 1,100 top-tier political appointments currently still need to be filled, and he has nominated just over 100 of them. That pace is way behind the Obama pace of appointments that was considered slow by historical standards. Max Steyer is president of the Partnership for Public Service. Aside from all the distractions in Washington, D.C. right now, he says these appointment delays are one more reason making it particularly difficult to get things done in Washington.
I think people actually feel a lot of effects. They just don't realize that they are feeling the effects of poor management in our government. It doesn't really feel like a problem for most folks to think about, well, there aren't political appointees in the top jobs in government. How is that relevant to them? In fact, it is, and you look at the State Department as a classic example of that, where you've had the Secretary, Rex Tillerson, and more recently a deputy come in, but virtually nobody else. And what you then see is a world that doesn't know who they talk to in dealing with us. So there was an interesting article I saw recently about Israel saying that they didn't have the normal people that they would consult with in the political position, the State Department, that they needed. And that's true everywhere. And the consequence for Americans is profound, because our government is, most fundamentally responsible for our security, but it's also responsible for all kinds of other things that we care about, whether it's the quality of the environment around us or all kinds of resources for people who desperately need them and others who need them in different ways, like the education system. So it is our one collective asset as a people in this country for dealing with our most significant problems. So it's real important that we get this right, and right now we're in trouble.
Do you have any example of a vacancy rippling through various communities and having a tangible effect?
Sure. So I want to be clear on something, which is our system is resilient. And when we talk about vacancies, when there is not a political appointee that's been confirmed by the Senate, and there are 1,100 of those across government, it doesn't mean the job is actually vacant. There will be someone who's serving in an acting capacity. And in almost all instances, that will be a career professional that, in almost all instances, maybe one of, if not the most qualified person to do the job. But they're the acting individual. And for me, the metaphor is the substitute teacher. So you think about your own experience in the classroom. It may be a wonderful educator, but if someone's a substitute teacher, They're not perceived as having the real authority. They don't view themselves as being responsible for the long term, or in most instances, taking on the challenging problems, because they know someone else is coming in real soon. And that's what we have right now. We have a government that is led by substitute teachers, people who may be phenomenally qualified as individuals, but are not positionally situated to do the jobs as well as we need them. You asked the question, well, what impact does it have? And I can't tell you that there's some specific disaster that has occurred as a result of having a substitute teacher in place. But you and I both know that if you have a school full of substitute teachers, the students in those in that school are not going to get the education that you want them to have.
What is the likelihood that because of vacancies and the scale of the vacancies that you've described, that certain aspects of the government are going to be taken advantage of, that regulations are going to be, you know, stepped around, that certain people are going to get a wave through, a green light, that that sort of thing is going to happen?
So there's absolutely that risk. There's also the risk that the government doesn't keep up with the world around it. And that's a profound one that has been taking place earlier than this administration. We have a legacy government that has not been agile, that has not actually changed in the ways that are necessary to allow us to receive the services in the ways that we need them. It sub-optimizes, you know, a vital resource to us and across the board. Now, we haven't talked about the even more dangerous issue, which is what happens when a crisis occurs. So we basically have a ticking time bomb, and it's a scary one. We ought to be concerned about this. We're losing out in today, and we have a real risk in the future.
Is there any evidence that some of the vacancies are driven by people who came into the administration thinking it was going to be an exciting place to work and have now been very quickly disillusioned?
Not really, in part because there are not that many that have actually been confirmed. We're talking about 43 people out of that 1,100, and you know, we would argue they're a smaller subset that are really important. So we haven't really seen the kind of attrition that ultimately does take place. And I do want to put this in context. I don't think any prior president has done this well. It has taken presidents over a year to get their core team on the field, and that's not good. In the world we live in, and certainly with 4 years, if you, you know, waste that front end year, that's a big problem. This administration is just doing it a lot worse than it's been done before, and we're going the wrong direction.
Is there any particular government agency or set of agencies that's more vulnerable because of these vacancies that consumers and citizens should watch out for?
The challenge is it's across the board. You know, we have a FEMA director nominated but not yet confirmed. You know, hurricane season has started. I testified yesterday, you know, in front of the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate about the Indian Health Services, and they're facing just profound challenges. There's a really strong acting director of the independent of the Indian Health Services, but again, you don't have a confirmed individual in there who can take on what is really a big set of challenges over the long term. So anywhere you turn, our government is actually responsible for an amazing array of critical functions, and it's not led in the way we need it to be led. And that ought to be concerning to people. And you pick your area, it's going to be important.
Max Steyer is president of the Partnership for Public Service, based in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Progressive rock has been around for a while. It's difficult to categorize. It's progressive, perhaps, because it wants a little respect. And by morphing classical rock and improvisational sound, complex compositions, weighty lyrics, prog rock has nailed down an audience hungry for something beyond doo-wop and has built a loyal following of diehard prog rock fans since the 1970s. David Weigel has been following prog rock for decades. His day job is as a national reporter for the Washington Post, but his new book, released this week after years of moonlighting as a prog rock historian, is The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Progressive Rock.
The classification of what this music was kind of controversial, and the bands who were actually making it, some of them did not like the label progressive, but some frankly kind of glommed onto it, and the record industry glommed onto it. Harvest Records, Virgin, progressive was basically music kind of starting, growing out of the psychedelic and beat movements in the 60s in the UK, and then evolving to bring in influences from classical music, from Asian music, from experimental kind of bang on a found objects music. But it was super expansive, and that's one thing I found in talking to some of these musicians, especially because Prague as an aesthetic was not like punk, where people were ever really proud to wear it. Some of them quibbled with calling it that.
And part of this was fans yearning for a musical aesthetic that had more depth than just the pop world.
These guys were about as young as the punks were when they came along and blew it up 10 years later when they started. This was radical and challenging and new. It was something breaking out of the form they were used to, which was, you know, Motown covers and sounding a lot like bands that were popular already. Bands like Yes and Soft Machine and King Crimson, they were working in recognizable forms in ways that were just bracing. I mean, Soft Machine, for example, playing at the Proms, the annual BBC classical music competition, as an example of what was new. Being elevated as music that was worth listening to if you were a serious fan, and at the same time, bands like Emerson, Lake and Palmer anchoring festivals for 400,000 people. You know, the equivalent of someone now who's going to festivals to hear Chainsmokers or something. They were listening to this, but I think the relationship was much less random and changeable. It was really devoted because these artists were seen as hunkering down and writing challenging music, not just hits.
It was a fusion, and there was a lot of fusion to be done. I mean, I remember the Miles of Isles tour of Joni Mitchell, which had Pat Metheny in it, you know, and I mean, and Jaco Pastorius played in that band. I'll try to keep myself open up to you. That's a promise that I made to love when it was new, just like Jericho. I said that these walls. Now, in disparaging prog rock, I remember a fan once told me, a fan of all music, once told me that what prog rock legacy is that it brought back the light show guy.
Yeah, it did. I have a lot about light shows in the book because at the time, the idea of an enveloping concert experience where you'd go and King Crimson would have a radical light show sync the music, or Hawkwind would have a 6-foot-tall female body-painted dancer interpreting the music, where Yes, you could see them as the show went on, slowly rotating or coming to the stage in sort of a cocoon. Stuff that was kind of pioneered by them, frankly, made fun of by Spinal Tap. This was just dynamic stuff that was easy to make fun of, but at the time, I mean,
it's like opera,
side
it's
of
theater.
The music. Yeah, well, they all had this sense of pomp, but not in a negative way. I always am hesitating to say pompous. No, it was full of pomp, but full of pomp because it was fun. It was really fun to see a band take over a giant venue and play a classical music piece, reinterpret it, and then smash a synthesizer at the end of it. It became kitschy later, but some of these people, like Rick Wakeman, were aware of the kitsch in the time and leaned in. It was just really fun to take these giant conventions, play around with amazing technique, compared to what, not just what replaced it, but what I see with a lot of rock now is, you know, four guys with t-shirts go on stage and strum for an hour and a half and they're off.
Who were your favorite bands?
King Crimson, especially because they have in reconstituting in the last couple of years with a new 3-drummer lineup, and as is usual with King Crimson, Robert Fripp, with whatever musicians he thought made the music sound fresh in the year he's playing it. I think they're fantastic, and there's a diversity there that it's fun to play them and shuffle if you have guests over. You can tell there's a through line that it's the same band, but it's not the same genre. The artists I like got bored with what they were doing quickly. I think Yes holds up, I think Soft Machine holds up, and Gentle Giant.
Oh, I love Gentle Giant.
Gentle Giant's one that I discovered as I was interviewing fans to kind of poll and get a sense of what needed to be included in the book. Gentle Giant, just a technically brilliant band that used a lot of things that just did not make sense to anyone else in rock music. Now the wind seems so cold, seems so old. like Renaissance choral vocal harmonies and strange chordal phrasings. A band that went to open for Black Sabbath, and I have some of them in the book. They were crazy. Awkward marriages put together by these critics. Because it's unique and because it was so gleeful about bending what was normal in pop and rock music.
Progressive rock! Just take a gander at that cover art and try to pretend you're not already inspired.
It's like something out of a dream.
Painted by our greatest living artist, Mr. Roger Dean.
Hey!
Everyone's very aware of what you can make fun of with progressive rock, and sometimes the fans get to make fun of it first, like any good fan base.
The fact that they're still challenging themselves mm-hmm. means that they're having fun. It's not just, oh, play the songs, yeah. collect a check, you know, don't die.
I think the appreciation technique, there's been a reappreciation of things that were identified as outsidery and a bit geeky from the popularity of Game of Thrones to even just the big hit box office comedies now are people who are kind of wordy. And I've seen some of this music get wrapped up in there. But when I've seen pop culture appropriate progressive recently, it has been a little bit less mocking. Or if it's mocking, it's so specific that you know they're in on it.
Dave Weigel, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Weigel's book, The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Progressive Rock, is out in bookstores this week. The jury is out on whether Pink Floyd was a better band than Yes. That jury may be out forever. We've been talking about real-life juries, though, and pressure jurors put on each other and pressure from high-profile cases like the Cosby case. You've got some stories.
This is David in New York City. I've served on a grand jury, which is very different from a trial jury, but there was indeed pressure to all vote a certain way. Now, I don't know if it would have made any difference in how we voted, but the prosecution seemed to be neglecting in every single case, and that is to show us that this suspect who we're accusing is the one who committed it. And I was painfully aware of this through the whole process, and yet, even so, the pressure got to me, and I voted out of groupthink or peer pressure.
This is MJ from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Yes, I served for 3 months on a grand jury. As the foreperson, I worked very hard for the rest of the jury not to feel any pressure from the district attorney. It was an incredible experience to see our legal system at work, and I would recommend people to volunteer.
Great to hear those stories. Call us at 877-8-BY-TAKE or find us on Twitter. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. By Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.